Book of Lamentations, chapter 1, we'll commence reading at verse 1. How doth the city sit solitary, that was full of people? How is she become as a widow, she that was great among the nations, and princess among the provinces? How is she become tributary? She weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers she hath none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. Judah is gone into captivity because of affliction and because of great servitude. She dwelleth among the heathen. She findeth no rest. All her persecutors overtook her between the straits. The ways of Zion do mourn, because none come to the solemn feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Her adversaries are the chief. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children are gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her beauty is departed. Her princes are become like harts that find no pasture, and they are gone without strength before the pursuer. Jerusalem remembered in the days of her affliction and of her miseries all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy, and none did help her. The adversaries saw her and did mock her at her Sabbaths. Jerusalem hath grievously sinned. Therefore she is removed. All that honored her despise her, because they have seen her nakedness. Yea, she sigheth and turneth backward. Amen. We'll end our reading at verse 8. I am told by scientists that continually tears flow in our eyes. Now, of course, there are different types of tears. There are tears that will lubricate the eye, and that's why they continually flow. They need to occur if we are to have sight and to see clearly. If we ever get dry eyes, then our sight becomes greatly worsened. And eventually, if it does not get healed, it will go blind. There are tears that lubricate our eyes. There, of course, there are tears that cleanse our eyes. If you get some smoke into your eye, or you get a little bit of grit into your eye, and you try rubbing it, tears will begin to flow to try and cleanse the dirt out of your eye. There are tears that protect the eye and cleanse the eye and lubricate the eye. But of course, there are tears that come as a result of emotion. Tears that come as a result of joy, but then there are tears that come as a result of sadness, disappointment, and grief. Whenever we looked at the book of Jeremiah, we saw that Jeremiah was one who said in the 9th chapter, and indeed in the verse 1, he said, Oh, that my head were waters, and mine eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. And if you want then to look at the book of Lamentations in the chapter 3, and the verse 48, having made that prayer that his head would be as rivers of water, in verse 48 he now says, mine eye runneth down with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people. Mine eye trickleth down and ceaseth not without any intermission. The tears that Jeremiah had were not tears of joy. They were not tears that simply lubricated his eye or cleansed his eye. They were tears of immense sorrow. Because whenever we come into this book of Lamentations, the first thing I want you and I to understand is that this is a book of sorrow. Not of any type of sorrow, but it is, first of all, a book of intense sorrow. The Hebrew title that was given to this book is found in verse 1 and chapter 1. It is the word "how." That's the Hebrew title for this book, "How." Now, the term "how" here is not in the sense of a question. It's a sense of a cry. It is the idea of alas. It's a cry before God. We see it used elsewhere in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 17, where we read that David lamented the death of Saul and Jonathan his son. And David, in lamentation, he cried, "How are the mighty fallen?" It was not a question that he was stating. It was a cry he was making. So Jeremiah, the very beginning of his book, he makes a lament, an alas. He says in verse 1, "How doth the city sit solitary?" That was full of people. "How is she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princes among the provinces. How is she become tributary?" Jeremiah was so taken aback with grief and sorrow. The very beginning of this book, and indeed the entirety of this book, is a lament. How? Alas, look at what's happened. She who was great has now become nothing. The Greek term for this book, whenever the 70 Jews translated it into Greek, the Old Testament, they gave it the title of lament. That's where we get our English title today, the Lamentations. You'll also see in the title it's given, it is the Lamentations of Jeremiah. And that is because whenever you look at verses such what I've already shown you, the comparison in Jeremiah 9:1, the prayer that Jeremiah makes, and then indeed the declaration in Lamentations chapter 3, where there was that prayer that his head would be as waters, and then that answer that his head was as waters. And indeed, whenever you understand that the author of this book, the human author, was writing at a time around 586 BC whenever Jerusalem was taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. Many of the prophets didn't live at that exact time, but Jeremiah did. And whenever we read this book, it is a book filled with vivid detail of what happened in 586 BC. Whenever Nebuchadnezzar came, Jerusalem was destroyed. The city was burned, the gates were broken down, women were killed, children were killed. Famine originally had set in. Women would even cut their own children in two just to eat them. Jeremiah, seeing it all, he laments and he describes it in vivid detail. The city that once was great before God now has become nothing. Lamentations is a book of sorrow. It's a book, first of all, of intense sorrow. But it's also a book of loving sorrow. See, Jeremiah in this book, he's lamenting what's happening to a people who are sinful. He's lamenting about what is happening to a people who have been stubborn. Jeremiah has preached this people for over 40 years, and they have rejected him. They have neglected him. They have hated him. His own townspeople hated him. We read all Israel hated him. The king hated him. He was thrown into prison more than once. He was thrown into a dungeon. He was beaten within an inch of his life. He was hated, despised, rejected, neglected for over 40 years. We don't understand of one person, all his ministry, coming to know the Lord. And yet, he doesn't rejoice whenever Jerusalem is destroyed. He cries. This is a book of loving sorrow. Even the people that hated him, rejected him, and grieved the God whom Jeremiah loved. Yet Jeremiah still loves these people. He still has a care for these people. He does not react at seeing the destruction with thankfulness, but he reacts in sadness. He cried. We read there in Lamentations chapter 3 that his eyes trickled without intermission, without break. Lamentations is a book of sorrow, an intense sorrow, a loving sorrow, but also an important sorrow. If you look with me at chapter 1, how many verses are in it? How many verses are in chapter 1? And you will see that there are 22. Look at chapter 2. How many verses are in chapter 2? You'll see again that there's 22 verses. Look at chapter 4. How many verses are in it? And you'll see 22. Look at chapter 5. How many verses are in it? And you'll see again there are 22 verses. What is the significance of that? Jeremiah, as he wrote this book, he wrote it in such a manner that he wanted people to memorize it. He wanted people to remember it and to learn from it. He wanted this book to ever be imprinted upon the minds of the church, Old Testament and New Testament. You see, in the Hebrew alphabet, there are 22 letters. And in chapter 1, the first verse begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The second letter of chapter 1 begins with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The third verse of chapter 1 begins with the third letter of the Hebrew alphabet, all the way through to the end. Coming into chapter 2, it starts all over again. Coming into chapter 4, it starts all over again. Coming into chapter 5, it starts all over again. 22 verses in chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5, all following the Hebrew alphabet, that it would be memorable for the people. You see, the lessons that Jeremiah is writing about, the sorrow he has over these people, he wants the people to remember. He wants the people to learn from it. He will describe their sins. He will describe the punishment that God brought upon them. He'll describe the anger of God, how far sin took them. He wants people to remember that sin is not to be played with. Sin is not to be toyed with. You see sin in your life, you turn from it. You see sin in the lives of other people, you cry to God to turn them from it. Sin brings sorrow. Immense, horrific sorrow. You may say, well, what about chapter 3? Well, if you look at chapter 3, you'll see that there's 66 verses in chapter 3. And the only reason it's different is because there's three verses that all begin with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then verses 4, 5, and 6 all begin with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then verses 7, 8, and 9 begin with the third letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And all the way through until all the Hebrew's letters are covered. This is a book that is to be remembered. Not just by the people in the Old Testament, but indeed by you and I this evening. It's a book that Jeremiah wanted the people to remember. It's a book that he wanted them to learn. You see, it is wise to learn from other people's mistakes. You and I can say we can learn from our own. It's far wiser to learn from the mistakes of others. Let us begin to look at this book of sorrow. Before I do, let me just ask you a question. How broken are you, and I ask this to myself, how broken am I regarding the sins that are around us? Are we broken regarding our own sin? Does it grieve us? We have been looking at Luke's Gospel and the Lord's Day evenings, and for those that have been here, we saw that indeed the characteristic of someone who's genuinely saved, they will mourn over their sin. They can't continue in their sin with joy and delight and satisfaction and contentment. No, they see their sin before God, and it grieves them because it grieves God who loved them and gave everything for them. And as a result, people that are genuinely saved, while imperfectly, yet we will mourn over our own sin. Do we do that? Are we broken over our own sinfulness? We see ourselves failing, and it grieves us because we grieve the one who loved us. But are we also broken over the sins of others? We see the sins of those in our family. Do we pray that the Lord would change them? We see the sins of those in this town, this nation. Do we pray the Lord will change them? The Lord is being despised and is honored every single day through their sin. Are we broken? Jeremiah was broken. His eyes trickled without intermission. As I said, let us begin to look at this book of sorrow. And the first chapter is really all about Jerusalem's sorrow. You see, God has come now to judge the people of Israel for their repeated sin, their stubborn sin, their relentless sin. And God has brought judgment in the captivity through Nebuchadnezzar, taking a number in the captivity and destroying many others. And this sorrow is here described. The greatness of the sorrow is described by Jeremiah in the first 11 verses. And if you note that in these first 11 verses, we will read of Jerusalem spoken of in the third person, the term she or her or the city or Jerusalem or Judah. That will change coming from verse 12, whereby it'll be me and my and I, because Jerusalem then speaks herself. But the first 11 verses, Jeremiah is the one who's speaking about the sorrow that Jerusalem has and about the greatness of this sorrow. Because if you look with me at verse 1, the Jerusalem is quiet. How doth the city sit? Solitary. You see, Jerusalem used to be filled with people. It used to be filled with singing and dancing and joy. It used to be bustling around the city. Not anymore. The city that once made a great impact in the world
It's now solitary. Very few people are found in her streets. We also find at the end of verse 1 that this city, which was once great among the nations, princes among the provinces, ruling over the other nations of the world, yet now she's become tributary. She's despised as nothing but a slave. In verse 2, we find that Jerusalem is abandoned. She who looked to ungodly nations to be her friend have now found that her friends have abandoned her. Verse 2 says that she weepeth sore in the night. Some of you this evening know what it is to weep sore, perhaps, over the losing of loved ones. We read here that Jerusalem weepeth sore in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she hath none to comfort her. Then the verse 2, not merely did these ungodly so-called friends abandon her, but they've actually turned on her. The ungodly nations hated her. And they dealt treacherously with her and became her enemies. She's got nowhere to support her. In verse 3, Jerusalem is exhausted. At the end of it, we find that she finds no rest. She's weary. She's no satisfaction. In verse 4 to 5, we find that Jerusalem is miserable. She mourns. She's afflicted for the multitude of her transgressions in verse 5. We find in verse 4 that she's in bitterness. She has no joy. Verses 6 and 8, we find that Jerusalem is defiled. Her beauty is departed. She's dressed in nothing but nakedness and in filthiness. In verse 7, we find that Jerusalem is mocked. And here, this once great city, this city which was looked up to by all the nations around, under the likes of King David, under the likes of the reign of King Solomon, the Queen of Sheba, coming all the way just to look at this great nation. Rejoice that there was no nation all the world like it. And now it's despised. It's filled with shame. Jeremiah describes the greatness of the sorrow. But while the greatness of the sorrow is described by Jeremiah in the first 11 verses, in verses 12 to 17, we see that the heaviness of this sorrow is felt by Jerusalem. As I said, the pronouns now change from the third person, such as she and her, to now the first person, my, me, and I. If you look at me at verse 12, we'll see an example of that. Is it nothing to you? This is Jerusalem speaking. Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow like unto my sorrow, which is done unto me, wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me in the day of his fierce anger. Jerusalem feels the heaviness of her suffering and all that she's going through. The second part of verse 13, she will say that God has caused her much pain, like one who puts fire into a person's bones. She's restless. She's always feeling it. There's no contentment. There's no satisfaction. The end of verse 13, we also read that she declares that God has made her desolate. She's fainting all the day. Verse 14, she declares that God has bound suffering upon her, like yoke will be bound upon oxen. It's heavy. It's burdensome. It's wearying. In verse 15, she will declare that God has trodden her under his foot, crushing her like grapes, just like they're crushed in a wine press. Verse 16, she says, for these things I weep. Mine eye runneth down like water, because the comforter that should relieve my soul is far from me. Well, Jerusalem will seek comfort from someone, anyone. You just look at verse 17. Zion spreadeth forth her hands. Anybody come for me? Anybody help me? But the answer is given, there is none to comfort her. You see, the greatness of the sorrow is described by Jeremiah, but the heaviness of the sorrow is felt by Jerusalem. And in the third part of this first chapter, we see that the justice of Jerusalem's sorrow is then confessed by Jerusalem. Why is Jerusalem in such a situation? Why is she in such a state? Why is she so lowly? Why is she a slave? Why is she naked? Why is she filthy? Why is God treading her under his foot? Why is there this fierce wrath and anger? Well, verse 18. Against his commandment. Verse 20, the second part of it. She will declare, I have grievously rebelled. See, Jerusalem confessed that it was because of her own sin. It was her own rebellion. What's the application you and I this evening? Surely it's very simple. May the Lord open up your eyes and open up my eyes to see But one poet described it: sin takes you further than you want to go. Sin keeps you longer than you want to stay. And sin costs you more than you want to pay. So often you and I can be tempted to go our own way. We were tempted to think, you know, it doesn't really matter, this little sin that's in my life. You know, nobody else knows about it, nobody else sees it, or perhaps even everybody else does it. I know it's wrong, but it's just a little sin. Jerusalem began with a little sin. And went further, further, further. Until a generation rose up not knowing God. God brought great judgment upon that nation. Sin takes you and I further than we ever want to go. Having seen Jerusalem's sorrow in chapter 1, notice with me in chapter 2 that we now see Jehovah's anger. You see, the focus of the second chapter is not Jerusalem. It's the anger of the Lord. You look at me, please, at verse 1 of the chapter. Jeremiah speaks about the Lord. He says, "How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger?" At the end of the verse, we see that he remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger. In verse 2, we see the Lord hath swallowed up all the inhabitations of Jacob and hath not pitied. He hath thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He hath brought them down to the ground. Verse 3, he hath cut off in his fierce anger all the horn of Israel. Verse 4, he hath bent his bow like an enemy. And again in this chapter, we have 30 times this phrase, "the Lord hath," or "he hath." This without doubt is a chapter of the Lord's anger. We can see just a number of things within it. You now see Jeremiah's description of Jehovah's anger. It's a clear description. As I mentioned, 30 times there is a reference here to the Lord bringing this anger. 45 times in total, Jehovah's name is mentioned in this chapter, making it clear that Jerusalem's destruction, Jerusalem's captivity, the fact she's now trodden on their feet, it's not happened by accident. It's God himself has done it. It is a clear description of Jehovah's anger. It's also an intense description. 6 times over, Jeremiah specifically mentions Jehovah's anger. Verse 1, it's mentioned twice. Verse 3, it's described as a fierce anger. Many times over, we have already noticed, the Lord swallowed up the habitations of Israel. The Lord has bent his bow. The Lord has violently taken away his tabernacle. The Lord, verse 7, abhors his sanctuary. It's a tragic description of the Lord's anger. Because now, we read in verse 3, the Lord has cut off Israel. In verse 5, the Lord is as an enemy to Israel. In verse 7, the Lord has cast off his altar. These things would have been times of notice and of praise and significance in the Old Testament, the days of David. But not anymore. The Lord's cast off Israel. The Lord's cast off his altar. The Lord is as an enemy before the people. In verse 1, one commentator made a very interesting comparison. If you look at verse 1 of the chapter, we read, "How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud?" You think about a time whenever the Lord used a cloud to make a covering. You think of the Old Testament, whenever the children of Israel come out of Egypt, that land of great wickedness, that land of taskmasters, that land of the ungodly pagan Pharaoh who was stubborn and rebelling against the command of God to let God's people go. And the children of Israel coming out of the land of Egypt, they go to the Red Sea, and the Red Sea is in their way. And the Egyptians, in all their wickedness and all their stubbornness and all their rebellion, they chase against the people to destroy the people of Israel. But what does God do? He sets a cloud. See, God still looks upon the nation of Israel. But God is a cloud. He covers the Egyptians. But yet now, the cloud is not separating Israel and the Egyptians. The cloud is actually before the people of Israel. That's how far Israel's fallen. God does not look upon his people with favor. God looks upon his people with disgust. As we look at this description of chapter 2, we see it's also a complete description. Verse after verse, you go down, you will find out that the city is destroyed, the walls, the gates, the bars of the city, they've been torn down, they've been burned. The king is removed. The law is no more. The prophets, they see no vision. They aren't receiving words of hope. The elders are silent. The virgins have bowed their heads. And the Lord has done it all. He has brought it all to pass, bringing judgment upon the people. But we see something very sad in verses 11 and 12, in addition to everything else. In verse 11, Jeremiah declares, "Mine eyes do fail with tears. My bowels are troubled. My liver is poured upon the earth for the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the sucklings swoon." The idea of them fainting in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, "Where is corn and wine?" When they swooned as the wounded in the streets of the city, when their soul was poured out into their mother's bosom. And while you and I can make the application here very simple, again, of the wickedness of sin, that if it's not repented of and if it is continued, here God in his anger will pour out judgment upon this nation that's risen up and not known God. You know, you think of one of the godliest generations that ever existed in the time of Israel, and it was indeed in the time of Joshua. And Joshua, bringing the people into the promised land, after a time of failure, brought them into the promised land and conquered so much in the promised land, pleading the promises of God. Joshua's not perfect, made mistakes, but yet conquered so much. And yet we find, whenever it comes into the book of Judges, that after the generation of Joshua, after the generation of the elders who served under Joshua, we read that the people forsook the Lord God of their fathers. There rose up a generation that knew not the Lord. And as a result, they followed other gods, the gods of the people that were round about them, the Canaanites. And they bowed themselves unto the false gods. And Judges chapter 2, verse 12, we read, they provoked the Lord to anger. You know, it's easier for you and I just to become lax in our Christian walk, to not be as evangelistic before with our own families, not be as evangelistic with the area, just, well, we're saved, and you know, that's important, and that's everything, you know. But become less evangelistic and less reaching out to the world around us, and to our friends, the people that we meet, even to within this own church here. And eventually a generation rises up that doesn't even know God. Of course, salvation is of God alone. It's all by grace, not by our works and efforts. It's not what I'm meaning to say. But what we have here is a generation, as Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 3 said, a verse that's been imprinted in my mind since studying Jeremiah last week, Israel was holiness unto the Lord. Past tense. There were people that knew God and loved God and did a work for God. But there rose up a generation here that knew not God. Living in sinfulness and wickedness, God brought his fierce anger upon them. But I believe here there's another application that's very solemn as well, and very applicable to your own generation. You see, in verse 11 and verse 12, we find that the sins of the leaders and the sins of the people as a whole, it didn't just impact them. It impacted the children. You see, sinfulness and wickedness impacts more than you and me. It impacts the children, and it impacts the next generation, and it impacts the generation after that. If you turn me, please, to Psalm 106. Keeping your finger in Lamentations, but Psalm 106. Psalm 106. We read of those who, in verse 34, did not destroy the nations, did not cast them out whenever they went into the promised land, but mingled among the heathen and learned their works. Verse 36, this people, Psalm 106, they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils. They killed their children. They shed innocent blood, verse 38, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. The land was polluted. The land was defiled. Not just the family, not just the blood of the innocent was defiled, but the land was defiled, the land was polluted. Verse 9, thus were they defiled, the whole nation was defiled with their own works, and with the whoring with their own inventions. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance,
And he gave them, that is, the entirety of the land, into the hand of the heathen, and they that hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hands.
The lesson I want to highlight to you is that in certain occasions, the nation of Israel, there were a number. I don't believe it was everybody. I don't believe it was every family. I would say it was only a number. But a number in the land went into sin, such as sacrificing their own children and killing their own children, shedding the blood of the innocent. Justice was not brought. And as a result, the land itself was defiled. And God brought judgment upon the entirety of the land. You know, I can think of godly men like Solomon, or indeed like Hezekiah, godly kings, great kings, people we look up to and we admire and we tell our children about today. But yet because of Solomon's sin, judgment was brought upon the land after Solomon. Division, justice, slaughter came after Solomon because of Solomon's sin. Because of Hezekiah's sin, after his time, God brought judgment upon the land.
And I can say, well, you know, as long as judgment doesn't come in our day and generation, well, that's all okay. But what land are we leaving to our children? What land are we leaving, indeed, to our great-grandchildren, the generations that are to follow?
If it comes to the subject of abortion, there have been a number who have been very vocal, seeking that abortion is abolished in this land. And I appreciate the heart, commend it, desire it myself.
And while you and I could hate abortion for a number of reasons, we could hate abortion because we love our neighbor. We love the little child in the womb. We want the child to be born and they have life and opportunity. You know, we could hate abortion because of the love of our neighbor. And that's right and that's good. But you and I could also hate abortion because of the love that we have for God who hates such sin and wickedness. And the fact that God is not glorified, of course, that's the ultimate motivation to hate abortion. But
there is another motivation. It's the motivation of our own children. You say, I'm not going to sacrifice my child. What about the land that our children will be brought up in?
Because a justice is not brought upon our land, which as a land, legally commends abortion, legally allows it.
And the whole land's defiled.
This whole country, this whole province is defiled and polluted before God. And his wrath being stored up against this little province.
We say, I didn't vote for it. Well, neither did I.
But the pollution and the defilement and the anger and the wrath is there over the entirety of the land.
You know, you can hate abortion because it has not turned from what our children and what our grandchildren, what land will they receive? Jeremiah was one who saw the anger of God against a people. You and I see that God is the one who hates sin. See that God hates it. Has not repented from the whole land's defiled. Let us pray that even for our own children and our own grandchildren, the Lord will turn our own nation back from its wickedness and violence and unto God. And God, in the midst of wrath, will remember mercy. We see Jeremiah's description of Jehovah's anger in the first 12 verses, but we also see Jeremiah's exhortation from Jehovah's anger in verses 13 to 22. You see, the question is asked in verse 13 of this second chapter. Jeremiah says, what thing shall I take to witness for thee? What thing shall I liken to thee, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I equal to thee that I may comfort thee, O virgin daughter of Zion, for thy breach, that is thy wickedness, thy sinfulness, is great like a sea. You see, the sin that Jerusalem went into, they went into it knowingly, they went into it willingly, they went into it deliberately, they went into it stubbornly. And yet, now, Jeremiah, he exhorts the people. He tells them what to do, verse 18. He tells them, to have sorrow. To let tears, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give thyself no rest. Let not the apple of thine eye cease. See the reality of your sin before God and sorrow. Verse 19, then surrender. Arise in the midst of thy sorrow. Cry out in the night. In the beginning of the watches, pour out thine heart like water before the face of the Lord.
Basically, give your all to God. Surrender your life afresh to Him.
Supplication. Lift up thy hands toward Him that is God for the life of thy young children that faint for hunger in the top of every street. What was Jeremiah's exhortation? For the people to sorrow over their sin, to surrender their all to God, confessing their sin, and indeed then to cry for God to mercy, show mercy. And you see, here's the wonderful thing, that even in the midst of wrath, the Lord can show mercy. We looked at last week in chapter 2 of the book of Jeremiah that the Lord spoke about Israel's idolatry and Israel's cruelty and Israel's murder of the innocent. We looked at all of that, but yet we also saw in Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 12, that in the midst of all that wrath and wickedness and sinfulness and vileness, that God speaks to the people. Jeremiah 3, verse 12 and 13, go and proclaim these words, God says to Jeremiah to the people, return thy backsliding Israel, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you. For I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. Only acknowledge thine iniquity, that thou hast transgressed against the Lord thy God. Acknowledge thine iniquity. What's the message we need to give to the people of this land? It is that they would see their own sin. See as it is before God and confess it as it is before God, to acknowledge their own iniquity. And sorrowing over, grieving a holy, a pure, a good and gracious God, who every gift they've ever received has come from God, that they will then turn from all their sin and surrender all they have to God and cry for mercy in the merits of Christ. You see, there's hope here. There's hope in the midst of anger. Jeremiah then in verses 20 through to the end of the chapter, he'll make intercession because of Jehovah's anger. You see, he'll ask the Lord to consider a number of things. Verse 20, behold, O Lord, and consider to whom thou hast done this. He'll go on to ask that the Lord will consider the situation. The women who eat to their own young. Lord, consider this. Look at the state, look at the sin, look at the wickedness that's going on in this land. Lord, consider it. Lord, turn us from it. Consider our history, Lord. You know, this people once owned thee. This people once praised thee as a nation. You once called this people thy people. Consider the servants that have served thee well, that have been faithful to thee in the midst of this land. Consider the severity of the punishment, Lord. Men, women, and young children slain in the streets, suffering with hunger, dying in famine. Lord, consider it. Lord, in the midst of wrath, show mercy. This evening, you and I can be encouraged that Christ prays for us. He's the one who says to the Father, even regarding a wicked nation, a wicked land, he says to the Father, Father, consider the people whom I have chosen. Consider the people whom I purchased with my own precious blood. Consider the people I'm praying for you day and to you day and night. Consider the people that I have purchased at great cost. Consider, Father, the work of your own hands. Whenever God spoke to Jonah, and Jonah didn't want mercy shown to Nineveh, God rebuked Jonah. Why? Because God was the one who had made the people of Nineveh. God was the one who had provided the people of Nineveh day by day and looked after them. They were the work of God's own hands. And God, in love of his own work and his own handiwork, he wanted to save them. And I could also plead the words of Ezekiel 18, verse 32, whereby the Lord himself declares, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from the way and live. We could plead Revelation 4, verse 11, whereby the angels declare, thou art worthy, O Lord, receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure. Thy pleasure. They are and were created. God created every human being on this earth for his pleasure. And if he says he's got no pleasure in the death of the wicked, then surely we can take this general principle and cry that God would show mercy and turn people from their sin. Jeremiah chapter 1, sorry, Book of Lamentations, in the chapter 1, we have Jerusalem's sorrow, an immense and intense sorrow. Chapter 2, we have indeed Jehovah's anger, but in chapter 3, we then have Jeremiah's grief, and I'll just mention this briefly. For opening 21 verses, Jeremiah will speak about how the Lord has led him personally into darkness and has afflicted him in verse 1, and God's hand is turned against him God, verse 5, has built his anger against him. You may say, well, how could Jeremiah say such? Jeremiah has been faithful to God. Jeremiah has obeyed God. Jeremiah has told the people the message of God. Jeremiah has not been living in the wickedness and the sin. How could Jeremiah say such? How could Jeremiah be grieved? It's very simply. Because Jeremiah is the one who loves the people. As a spiritual father, as a prophet, he loves the people to whom he's preaching. Whenever he sees God chastising them, Jeremiah himself is afflicted. You see, he sees himself as one of the people. Oh, not in rebellion and sin, but he sees himself as one who loves them. For each of us that are parents this evening, you and I will know the old expression. It was said to us, I've no doubt, said to me anyway, whenever I was being disciplined as a young child, you know, my parents said, this hurts me more than it hurts you. Didn't believe it at the time, but I understand it now. Jeremiah is a spiritual father to these people. He sees them hurting, and it hurts him more than it hurts them. You see, Paul was one who looked at stubborn, rebellious Israel that's crucified the living Savior, and yet he said, my heart's desire and prayer to God is that Israel be saved. And I could look at Christ himself after being rejected for all his ministry, being hated all his ministry. He turned around and said in Matthew 23, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee, thy children together, even as a hen gathered her chicks under her wings, and you would not. See, Jeremiah was grieved in this chapter, grieved over those whom he loved, because they were suffering. And again, the application comes. We can either be grieved even over those that hate us and rebel against us and oppose us. We love our enemies, as we looked at 2 Lord's Days ago. And we cry that the Lord will show mercy and save them. You see, there is hope here. Because one of the most famous verses out of the entirety of this book is found in Lamentations chapter 3. You see, Jeremiah lives in hope. Because in verse 22 he says, it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. He goes on to say, his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. You see, the Lord was the one who had shown Jeremiah, for those who were here last week, God showed Jeremiah that even in this wicked nation, even in the midst of wrath, God was going to preserve a remnant. God was going to have for himself a basket of good, healthy figs. A people whom God said that he was going to set his love upon, set his heart upon, that God was going to change them and turn them unto himself, that God was going to be their God. They would be his people, and that they would love God with all their heart, their whole heart, the term is. You see, Jeremiah believed that in the midst of wrath, God was still going to save a people. And so Jeremiah, even though he lamented over what was happening, yet he still had hope that God would still save a people. That God would still build his church. That the Savior who would come would still save the tribe of his own soul and be satisfied. The God who was going to kill and wipe away the basket of bad figs, that he would still raise up the basket of good figs. Why? Because God made a covenant, yes, to save the people unto himself. Yes, because of God's Christ, one was going to come and shed his blood, so the people must be saved. But more than that, because God's compassionate. He says in verse 22, thy compassions fail not. See, Jeremiah knew that God was a God of compassion. Read Ephesians chapter 2, he is rich in mercy. This evening, why you and I could look at the wickedness that is around, and how it deserves God's wrath, yet you and I can be encouraged. Yes, because God has given a covenant to save a people unto himself. Yes, because God has sent his Christ to shed his blood, and he will save the travail of his own soul and be satisfied. Yes, because of Christ's command to go into all the world and preach the gospel, and the gospel will, as it's proclaimed, that the gates of hell will not prevail. But more than that, you and I can plead that God will save simply because God's compassion. He's a character of compassion. And his compassions fail not. You see, in the midst of Jeremiah's grief, he had hope. And as a result, at the end of the chapter, he made a prayer to God on behalf of the nation. In verse 42, he confessed the sin of the people. And verses 48 to 54, which you noticed earlier, he says, mine eye runneth down with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people. When I trickled down and saith not without any intermission, till the Lord looked down, and behold from heaven, In verse 58, he says, O Lord, thou hast pleaded the causes of my soul. You see, Jeremiah knew there was one in the glory who was praying for the cause that Jeremiah was praying for. There was a Savior. Let me just conclude this evening and say in chapter 4 we have Jehovah's anger. We've already seen Jehovah's anger, but now it's reported again, because someone could turn around and think, well, if Lamentations just ended in chapter 3, you know what? Well, sin was bad, but God's willing to save in the midst of sin, and that's all. That's great. Just go away with the positive. You know, God's still willing to save in the midst of sinfulness. And that's true. Let us rejoice in that tonight. But let us not forget the warning. A whole chapter is spent here reminding us again of the wickedness of sin. Just because God is merciful, just because God's compassionate, and they don't fail, just because God will save a people unto himself, does not mean that we can live in sin. Because of their sin, Jerusalem was worse than all the creatures in the sea, we read. Verses 3 to 5. Mothers would not feed their sucking child. Fathers would not give their hungry children food. Verse 10, women would cut their children in two. Verse 13, falsehood would be taught. Peace and peace would cry whenever there was no peace. Verse 14, they would kill the innocent. Let us be warned this evening. Sin will take us further than we ever want to go. Sin will keep us longer than we ever want to stay. And sin will cost us more than we ever want to pay. And then the final chapter is Jerusalem's prayer. You see, Jerusalem here cries to God. Cries to God that God will remember their punishment, their reproach, their loss, their off inheritance, the suffering that they're going through, the pain they're going through. But as they close in verse 19 and verse 21, they ask the Lord with confidence, because they say, Thou, O Lord, verse 19, remainest forever. Thy throne, you're the one who has power. You're the one who has authority as a king to move and to forgive us. Verse 21, turn thou us unto thee, O Lord, and we shall be turned. You see, this book of Lamentations is an acrostic. This book of Lamentations, it's written in such a way through the Hebrew letters of the alphabet that we'll remember it. That because of Jerusalem's sin, God brought his fierce anger and wrath. People raised up not knowing God, and generation after generation would suffer. But yet in the midst of that, God says in his wrath, he'll remember mercy. Let us cry for mercy tonight. Let us also cry that the Lord would preserve us from going into sin, preserve us from being cold when it comes to evangelism, preserve us from negligence and praying for our land. The Lord will turn it away. And let us take the confidence of chapter 5. Lord, thou hast authority to turn our land back to thee. And Lord, thou hast power to do it. Lord, turn us and we will be turned. For thy glory above all, because you're not begrieved with our neighbors presently, but more than that, even for our own generation to come, Lord, show mercy. Let's just come to the Lord in a season of prayer.